This tape was recorded live at the 1983 Sunstone Symposium, held in Salt Lake City. The Distractions of Doubt, written and presented by James S. Jardine. Responding to the paper is Jerry Kindred. Another paper on belief, faith, and testimony was scheduled to be presented by Joseph Bentley, but he was unable to attend. Let's go now to the session in progress.
Ooh. Great. My name is Tony Morgan. I'd like to welcome you to this section and to let you know that Joe Bentley, who is scheduled to be here on the program, is ill and will not be here. That influences your attendance at this session. Now would be a good time to exit. The speakers will bow their head and notice you leave. We do, however, have the other two here who are listed on the program, and I'd like to introduce them and proceed. We have, first of all, a paper entitled The Distractions of Doubt. It will be read by Jim Jardine, who is indicated as a graduate of the Harvard Law School, has taught at the law school at Brigham Young University. He is a practicing attorney here in Salt Lake City, and also teaches as an adjunct faculty member in the honors program at the University of Utah. And responding to Jim's paper will be Jerry Kindred, who is a graduate of Brigham Young University and recently returned to live in Utah from California. He's on the executive committee of the Sunstone Foundation. He's a freelance writer. So without further ado, I'll turn the time over to Jim Jardine, and then Jerry will follow, and then with the time remaining, we'll open it up to questions and discussions.
Thank you, Tony. I appreciate all of you who felt the social pressure to stay when you learned that Joe Bentley wasn't speaking. I feel a lot of anxiety about participating in this program, not the least of which is associated with the quality of the other two panels. And I hope your investment of time is rewarded to some degree. I know that at least by my presence here, there's an implication that I regard myself as having something beneficial to say to you. I struggle with that thought. I observed last year for some of you that were at the session that sometimes I think I probably fit Walter Kerr's, the New York Times drama critic's, description of an actor as having delusions of adequacy. In any event, I appreciated the invitation. Peggy Fletcher, who invited me, is very persistent. And the reason that I've chosen to speak, I think, are several-fold, and I'd like to indicate them as somewhat of a preface for today's presentation. I participated last year as a respondent in a seminar entitled, in which a paper was delivered, entitled The Phenomenon of the Closet Doubter. And I ended up with the opportunity to take a role I feel relatively comfortable in, which is otherwise, which my wife describes as the orthodox role, and I wear that, I feel comfortable in that category. But to some extent, I suppose my appearance again this year indicates I'm something of a recidivist in this program. In any event, that experience last year on the panel led to a number of conversations with people about faith and doubt, and has caused me to think at some greater length than I had previously about the experience of doubt in the lives of people who are otherwise believers and how they deal with it. There is, as I think many of you would feel, and I think that it's been my discovery, not much written by church writers about the experience of doubt. And I'm not sure that I will add much, but my decision to speak, at least to a small degree, I suppose, is parallel to or analogous to the comment C.S. Lewis made when someone asked him why he had written the books that he wrote, and he said, well, I wrote what I've always wanted to read. And I decided that I would give a talk on what I've always wanted to read. I hope I can do it justice. I should also note for Jerry Kindred, who's going to respond, that the outlines of the papers that he's received several times this week have undergone radical change the last day or two. The absence of additional preparation days clears the mind marvelously, and I really came to closure on a lot of things this morning. Yes. The title that I put in the Sunstone program was The Distractions of Doubt. And the talks evolve, but somehow advanced titles don't. And so, to some extent, there will be some points that may not, it may seem tangential rather than directly relevant to that topic. Nevertheless, I really do want to talk about the subjects of faith and doubt, which are so interrelated that if you talk about doubt, you inevitably talk about faith. They are obviously, in my opinion, very subjective of individual experience and apprehension. The predicates of faith, in my opinion, are unique. The experiences of doubt, while frequently having similar sources, are inevitably different in terms of the way in which they're received in the unique systems that we are. And therefore, I will probably do injustice to almost everybody's experience and personal insight. I'm sure that my own experience with doubt is insufficient. My wife says that I have never doubted in my life. The fact is, I think that I have entertained doubts but never suffered them. And so that may disqualify me to some extent. I do know how strong the feelings are, and I decided to start with my favorite story on faith. It's not an LDS story, but it demonstrates, I think, some of the inherent... around the turn of the century, William James, the famous psychologist and Harvard professor, was lecturing to a group of people about the implications for psychology and philosophy that occurred when the true nature of the universe was discovered. That is, that the Earth was not the center of the universe, with the rest of the universe circling around it, but that the Earth was one of multiple planets circling the sun, part of a greater universe, and that the effect of that had a dwarfing man's sense of self-concept. And he went through all of the implications of that. And when he was done and the talk was over, and people, as they inevitably do, can't come up to the speaker afterwards, in the group that approached him was a little old lady who said to him, "Mr. James, that was a wonderful talk, and you're a very smart man, but your explanation was all wrong." And he said, "Well, how is that?" And she said, "Well, the Earth is not a mass circling the sun. It is a speck of dust on the back of a giant turtle." And James looked at her for a minute and decided, and instead of taking a direct approach, he tried a different one and said, "Well, if the Earth is a speck of dust on the back of a giant turtle, what does the giant turtle stand on?" And she looked at him and said, "Well, the turtle stands on the back of a second, far larger turtle." And James looked at her for a minute and said, "Well, then what does the second turtle stand on?" And she laughed and said, "It's no use, Mr. James. It's turtles all the way down." Well, there is, for those with strong faith, there are some folks for whom doubt is absolutely precluded because of the confidence that there are turtles all the way down. And for others, you have to be sure that your predicates are in place. But I think the story is illustrative of a lot of points, and it causes me to approach the subject reflectively and with humility. The one other prefatory point I'd like to make is that to some extent I'm speaking to a discrete, more narrow group, namely the group of people who have experienced faith to some degree and a resultant commitment from such faith. And after having made the commitment, had some set of spiritual experiences that have led them to that commitment, then enjoy or suffer, as the case may be, some set of doubts or doubt-producing experiences, and then have to wrestle with the way in which those are digested, analyzed, worked into their perspective on religious life. It applies to... My discussion applies, I suppose, to a lesser degree, to who have not had the prior faith-generating experiences. All of you who've read the title of my talk know that the top topic is the distractions of doubt, and to some extent I want to talk about how we doubt, how we go about experiencing doubt and dealing with it. And I suppose my starting observation, or one of the chief premises for my talk, is that the occurrence of specific doubts or doubt-producing experience in the lives of Mormons has a disproportionate and excessive impact, and that especially as compared with other Christians, that other Christians anticipate and deal with doubt in a much better, less emotionally impacted way than Mormons do. And I suppose, at least in a general way at the outset, that's a function both of our absolutist faith, or the absolutist way in which we express it, and of our disrespect institutionally for doubt. And today I'd like to attempt, at least in part, to analyze why doubt disables Mormons so disproportionately. Nietzsche once said, "If you tell me why, I'll tell you how." And I'm going to reverse that and try to tell you how we doubt, in an effort to explain to some extent why doubt does to us what it does. And then I'm going to conclude with some other observations about the way in which I think our doubts distract us. My first observation, or my first point, is an amplification of something I talked about last year, and that is the relationship of faith and doubt and language in our faith. It seems clear to me that our faith and our doubt is inextricably intertwined with the language we use in describing our faith and our doubt. I was always taught, and in fact have had experiences in my academic career, in which I was taught or told or discussed the fact that if we could not articulate what we were feeling or experiencing, then we didn't actually possess it. And our inability to define what was happening to us or what we were feeling at certain levels may indeed suggest that an illegitimacy about what we thought we were experiencing or feeling. I suppose that happens in lots of ways. I was in a class when I was trying to describe, it was a humanities class, and I was trying to describe a feeling that I had about a certain thing. And as I struggled to describe it, and I was a freshman, and I suppose I can ascribe now my inability to perform with a freshman's reach exceeding his grasp, but I could not really articulate what I was feeling or what I thought were a correct set of feelings people should have about something. And the teacher really took me to task, saying that the feelings, if they couldn't be articulated, couldn't be justified. I think on another, in another related way, we sometimes get this when you say to somebody, "I love you," and they say, "Why?" Be specific. And you then have to try to describe what it is that makes up the feelings of love you have. I suspect none of us could really, at least I couldn't, tell you in any sort of precise or clear way what it is that I feel for my wife or my children. There are feelings that are simply beyond expression. Because we cannot describe or record some of the feelings we have, especially spiritual experiences of feeling, I think that those spiritual experiences are susceptible, at least in one school, to subsequent revisionist history, which I think is a sad thing for reasons I will discuss. However, it seems to me it ought to be an obvious thing to us that the experiential constructs of faith are really, in fact, difficult to describe. I identify greatly with Ammon's sentiment in the 26th chapter of Alma that we cannot say the smallest part of what we feel. In my own life, I have had prayer experiences and other experiences which simply can't be recorded because I tried to do it in my journal without any success. And indeed, I think you can find examples of that in the scriptures. In the 32nd chapter of Alma, in which is regarded by Mormons as an effort to describe the process of faith, the prophet who's writing there talks about tasting light. Now, that's a classic mixed metaphor. And I don't think he is, in fact, describing experience. He's simply attempting to describe something which he can't get hold of. When Nephi lectures his brothers, he chides them for failing to feel the words of the Lord. He is again, I mean, we think of hearing words, And he is again struggling to describe something he can't. Throughout the scriptures, I think, at least on one level, you see people trying to describe things they can't get a hold of. I think that there are reasons why our spiritual feelings and experiences are difficult to describe, but at this point, I'd like to at length quote from an essay which I regard as one of the two or three most important pieces of writing to my own sense of understanding my religious life. It's an essay called Transposition by C.S. Lewis that is in a collection of essays called The Weight of Glory. And it's written in the context. Lewis took on the question about how do people who are not sure that they fully accept the phenomena of fundamentalist churches speaking in tongues, nonetheless evaluate the varieties of religious experience. And Lewis takes on the issue of explaining the language we use to describe religious experiences. And he begins by suggesting that there is what he calls the higher medium, which are a range of feelings or spiritual experiences we have, and a lower medium, which are the physical responses that are produced by that higher medium of feelings. And his premise is that there are a limited number of physical responses to an unlimited number of emotional or spiritual experiences. And he quotes from Samuel Pepys' diary as follows. With my wife last night to the King's House to see The Virgin Martyr, which was a play, and it is mighty pleasant. But that which did please beyond anything in the whole world was the wind music, when the angel comes down, which is so sweet that it ravished me, and indeed, in a word, did wrap up my soul so that it made me really sick, just as I have formerly been when in love with my wife, and makes me resolve to practice wind music and make my wife do the like. Lewis then says, takes this as an example of an instance where two physical responses represent opposite emotional experiences. And he says, for myself, I find that if during a moment of intense ascetic rapture, one tries to turn around and catch by introspection what one is actually feeling, one can never lay one's hand on anything but a physical sensation. In my case, it is a kind of kick or flutter in the diaphragm. Perhaps that is all Pepys meant by really sick. But the important point is this. I find that this kick or flutter is exactly the same sensation which in me accompanies great and sudden anguish. Introspection can discover no difference at all between my neural response to very bad news and my neural response to the overture of the magic flute. If I were to judge simply by sensations, I should come to the absurd conclusion that joy and anguish are the same thing. That which I most dread is the same with what I most desire. He then goes on. I take our emotional life to be higher than the life of our sensations, not, of course, morally higher, but richer, more varied, more subtle, and a higher level which nearly all of us know. And I believe that if anyone watches carefully the relation between his emotions and his sensations, he will discover the following facts. One, that the nerves do respond, and in a sense most adequately and exquisitely, to the emotions. Two, that their resources are far more limited, the possible variations of sense far fewer than those of emotion. Three, and that the senses compensate for this by using the same sensation to express more than one emotion, even as we have seen to express opposite emotions. Where we tend to go wrong is in assuming that if there is to be a correspondence between two systems, it must be a one-for-one correspondence, that A in the one system must be represented by small a in the other, and so on. But the correspondence between emotion and sensation turns out not to be of that sort. And there never could be correspondence of that sort where the one system was really richer than the other. If the richer system is to be represented in the poor at all, this can only be by giving each element in the poor system more than one meaning. The transposition of the richer into the poor must, so to speak, be algebraic, not arithmetical. And he then gives what I think is a great concrete example for what may not be an altogether clear explanation. He says, suppose you are trying to explain to somebody who has never heard the range of musical instruments that exist in the world what Beethoven's Fifth Symphony sounds like, and you have only a piano to demonstrate to them, and you say to them, this is what it sounds like, da 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 da, and then you start saying, this is when the violins come in, and And this is when the full orchestra hits, and you try to describe to them, and they are hearing the notes but don't have the slightest idea of the sounds you are describing. They, on one sense, understand the music, but on the other hand, don't have the vision of the higher medium. Now, I think, to me, that there is evidence of that, of this proposition in the New Testament. In one series of chapters, there's reference to exquisite joy and exquisite pain by the same author. In one sense, probably describing the same physical sensation for really different emotional or spiritual experiences. Now, I think that there are a couple of consequences of this which are really important to us in understanding our faith and what happens to us in both faith and doubt. Because what is happening in the lower medium, namely our physical sensations, can only be understood if we understand the higher medium. For example, when I had just returned from a mission, I was visiting with a friend of mine who was a fraternity brother of mine, and he told me he was engaged and that he'd known this girl for 3 weeks. And I said to him, "How could you decide so quickly?" And he said, "Well, I was fasting last Sunday and we're on Temple Square and I just had a strong feeling." And I said, "Couldn't it have been a hunger pain?" Well, in one sense, he was describing, he understood the lower medium to the higher medium, which, and I did not. The second consequence of this is it seems to me that it is no good browbeating the critic or the person who is critical of you, of an attempt to describe the higher medium, because they approach this transposition and the understanding of physical sensations from below, and on the evidence available to him, his conclusion is the only possible one he could reach. But this understanding, I think, explains to a large degree the great frustration we feel when people who have had a spiritual experience try to explain what that means to somebody who has never had a spiritual experience, because our tendency is to describe it in terms of the physical sensation, the lower medium, and people say, you know, the burning in the heart could be a result of a pizza you ate at 10 o'clock, for instance. And secondly, when we go back, as we sometimes do, and try to understand or think back through the experiences which we have regarded as spiritual experiences in our life and which are the foundations of our faith, which reflection is sometimes caused because of doubts that come into our lives, it is possible to go back and do revisionist history by attributing the sensations which at this time seem clearly associated with a spiritual experience to some other producing mechanism. Secondly, in the area of faith and language, because we as a people cannot articulate precisely what it is that we feel or experience in the realm of spiritual experience, in my opinion, we have developed a shorthand means of expression or communication. And that shorthand means is the phrase, "I know the church is true." I think that phrase really describes, which is used by hundreds of thousands of people in the church, literally describes hundreds of thousands of different experiences. And indeed, it comes closer to describing our position than it does our experience. Now, for those of us who know what that shorthand phrase means, when we hear people say, "I know the church is true," it echoes in our lives to a set of experiences that have brought us to a position of commitment and faith. But we don't mistake the words for the experience. But for those people who haven't had such experience and haven't become practiced in the language of the church, when they hear the phrase, "I know the church is true," it can be enormously misleading because it creates in them expectations which are false in some ways. And I want to deal with that. But it seems to me that indeed the phrase, "I know the church is true," has passed from being shorthand language into sort of canon law in the church, because I think the evidence of that is I have a friend who's a bishop who on occasion bears his testimony by saying, "I'm persuaded the church is true," and it drives all the people in his flock crazy. Because they're so attuned to the shorthand phrase. To amplify on the point that I was making a minute ago, I do think that the use of the phrase or words, "I know the church is true," can come to have a life of their own for better or worse. And indeed, we begin to live on the words rather than our actual experience. And if we're not regenerating experience, pretty soon we mistake the words as descriptive of our faith rather than the experiences they're meant to convey. I don't think there's any question that words can have a life of their own. I grew up learning from my friends to say I hate State Farm assignments before I ever went on them. And they were always self-fulfilling prophecies. Most importantly, it seems to me, the phrase "I know the church is true" leads at least some people to have expectations about having absolute knowledge and therefore no doubt. And I think that's just contrary to our theology. Faith, it seems to me, is something different than absolute or perfect knowledge of the divine origin of all the tenets of the restored church. When we're admonished to have strong faith, the presumption is that we can alternatively have weak faith. Ether 12 and 6 tells us that it's after the trial of our faith that the witness comes, so obviously doubt is part of the experience which believers are intended to have. Indeed, it seems to me faith and doubt tend to be motivating principles, whereas knowledge is not. And when people expect to have absolute knowledge about all the tenets of the church, they are inevitably going to be disappointed for reasons I want to discuss further. Finally, just one or two other points about faith and language. It seems to me that thus our inadequate language can come to be or to cause us to be distracted from what the real core of our faith is, and that we have to recognize the inherent nature of our religious language as being other than the real experience which we have in the religious life, and that to the extent that we come to believe in our language rather than our experience, we'll be distracted. My second point is an expansion of the what I said was the original proposition of this talk, which is that we are disproportionately debilitated by our doubts in the church. We have an unbounded confidence in our own testimonies. We are taught to regard our testimonies, or hope that our testimonies are unwavering and so firm that they'll never be shaken. And we articulate our testimonies in a way that leaves no room for the experience of doubt. And when doubts come to us, as I believe they inevitably do, we are so unprepared for them that our reaction or response is often wholly disproportionate. And it seems to me that we tend to have really two different responses to doubt among believing, practicing Mormons. The first is that we feel guilty, as though doubt is sinful. And in order to avoid the guilt, we try to deny the experience, which is real, i.e., the fact that we've had a tragedy in our lives, which is difficult to square with our view of a kindly heaven, or we've had a bishop who has been disappointingly insensitive to things that we think he ought to be inspired about, or a whole other range of things. I think there is reason for that guilt, and it's a reason which people who have not come to faith may not fully appreciate, but I think is very real. When our faith is first fixed, that is, when we go through the process of studying it out and analyzing it and deciding where we're going to come out, and we have a certain set of spiritual experiences, a transformation occurs from intellectual inquiry to emotional commitment. When that happens, we accept the psychological exclusion of doubt, even though there continues to exist an intellectual recognition of the possibility of dispute. More importantly, faith becomes personalized. We conclude that God is there, and the inevitable conclusion of that is that we are His, and our faith is no longer intellectual, it is relational. That is, our belief in the church is not an intellectual belief in an institution, but a commitment to another person. It is love, and it is a love which extends to the church. And to some extent, Chesterton's observation that love is not blind, love is bound, applies. And we are then, when that happens, not blind to the faults and the institutional inadequacies of the church, but we're bound to it in ways that result from the resultant love that comes from faith. When we are in that position, doubts that occur in our lives inevitably, therefore, must be regarded by us as disloyalty. That is, disloyal acts to the relationship that we have. In the same way that when you're married, doubts about marriage or doubts about your spouse are disloyal, doubts about the gospel are disloyal to the God we have accepted as our Father. The second thing that I think sometimes happens to people when doubts come in is that they feel devastated. As I indicated, we are taught in the church that our faith should be so rock-like that there is no room for doubt. And if that is our apprehension of what will happen to us in life, when doubt comes, we have this devastating feeling that our faith has failed us. I have experienced that in some interviews and discussions I've had with people who describe having had a patriarchal blessing not apparently come true, or having had some other experience, and they just feel devastated by it, not because the experience is big, but because the room for potential doubt in their pre-existing testimony was so small. And a fissure occurs because they have not contemplated that doubt would occur. When that happens, I think we lose all sorts of balance. It seems to me that that is a real problem for Mormons, and that we need to reorient our views of faith generally and our regard for our own faith to recognize that doubts will come and to deal with them with balance and not in a disproportionate way, so that we don't magnify the experience by the emotional response we have to it. In my opinion, doubt is a dialectic necessity to faith. I think that the second chapter of 2 Nephi that talks about opposition in all things clearly contemplates that there will be opposition to faith, which is doubt. John Taylor said, "He who has never doubted has never known." Some of you may have seen a great interview about 6 months ago that William F. Buckley did of Malcolm Muggeridge, who was a recent and notable convert to Christianity. Muggeridge said, "The only people who never doubt are the materialists," and I think that's probably right. We should expect doubt, just as we should expect hardship, tragedy, disappointment, and the fact that righteous prayers are not always granted. And since life, in my opinion, is a function of expectation, if we expect that doubt will come, then we'll deal with the doubt itself without having to deal with the emotional imbalance which the doubt has produced. Now, there's even a recognition of this, the fact that doubt is a part of life in the New Testament. When the Savior is felt by Thomas, and Thomas then believes, he says, "Thomas, because thou hast seen me, thou hast believed. Blessed are they who have not seen and yet have believed." And so at least on that score, it seems to me that there's a recognition that people who have not seen and believe, that is, the people who have faith but not absolute knowledge, are more blessed. Of course, the dilemma about this is that if doubt is part of life, as I suggest, we still come up against the scriptural injunctions against entertaining doubt. In Luke, the 12th chapter of Luke, as one example, we are told, "Neither be ye of doubtful mind." And so how do you resolve the issue of the fact that doubt is part of life, but we're not to have doubts? And it seems to me that the model we're given is the model in the 9th chapter of Mark, where the father comes to the Savior with a son who's had the evil spirits since birth, which the other apostles could not cast out. And the Savior says to him, "Dost thou believe?" And the father says, "Lord, I believe. Help thou my unbelief." That is the model. We do have unbelief, but our approach is to pray to the Lord to be aided about it. The third point, and you'll see that these are not linear thoughts, but random and tangential, is the relationship between behavior and belief, which in my opinion is little appreciated. It seems clear to me, and I think modern philosophy and science is now recognizing the fact, that our knowledge is a function of our behavior. And for much of what follows, I am indebted to a fellow by the name of Tony Kimball, who many of you will know. Eric Erickson, the noted child psychologist and biographer, gave a lecture that I attended once a number of years ago, and in the course of that lecture he said something that I wrote down and has become a part of my recognition of this point. He said, "Our knowledge is tied to the conditions under which it is obtained." And I think that's as true of spiritual knowledge as it is of any other kind of knowledge. But Erickson regarded that as a cardinal principle of psychology. Jacob Bronowski, who was a lecturer in The Ascent of Man and a raving materialist, nonetheless recognized this principle as well in an interview in The American Scholar in 1974. He said, "There is an intimate relationship, not between what is and what ought to be, but between what we regard as knowledge and how we ought to behave to obtain it. No amount of philosophic sleight of hand can get rid of this relation." He goes on to say in that essay, in that interview, "Knowledge is a systematization of those aspects of reality which we catch at the edge of our vision so that they form a coherent set of explanations. How do we do that? How do we get this knowledge? And this is the key point. By behaving in a certain way. By adopting an ethic for science that makes knowledge possible. Therefore, the very activity of trying to refine and enhance knowledge, of discovering what is, imposes on us certain norms of conduct. And he goes on to talk about what he thinks the norms of conduct are for discovering scientific knowledge. In a great book written in the 1960s, A Theory of Scientific Revolution, Thomas Kuhn also postulates that in order to make advances in science has to accept certain premises or propositions which cannot be demonstrated as true, and that they make advances as far as they can go on that set of premises, and then somebody will undertake to evaluate one of those premises and demonstrate problems, and the next scientific revolution takes place. But that the acquisition of knowledge depends on complying with certain conditions which require to some extent an act of faith. I think that's what the 32nd chapter of Alma teaches, that there are necessary preconditions to the experience or the acquisition of spiritual knowledge. In the 11th chapter of Matthew, we're told, "Take my yoke upon you and learn of me." And as I understand it, taking upon us the yoke of the Lord, as he is there speaking, means to comply with the conditions upon which spiritual knowledge and spiritual experience are predicated. Now, the importance of this understanding, at least to me, is that when we terminate the conditions of spirituality, we terminate the possibility of obtaining additional factual spiritual knowledge, and that there is therefore an ethic of religion, just like Bronowski's ethic of science. We don't load the dice when we comply with those ethics. Rather, we create a set of conditions under which knowledge can be obtained. And the preconditions to the acquisition of spiritual knowledge are multiple, but I think you're familiar with at least some of them. Humility being one of them. Fasting, in many instances, is a precondition to the acquisition of spiritual knowledge. Almost more important than anything else is submission. The preparation to accept whatever the consequences of the spiritual knowledge or experience contain or mandate. A great example of a formula involving preconditions is the 27th verse of the 12th chapter of Ether, which many of you know, in which the Lord talks about teaching us about our own weaknesses, the process of spiritual self-knowledge. And in that verse we're told, "And if men come unto me, I will show unto them their weakness. I give unto men weakness that they may be humble." And then the Lord goes on to tell us how he deals with that. But the precondition to having our own weaknesses revealed to us is to go to the Lord about our weaknesses. Now, I know that there are some of you who will say, again, you're setting up a circumstance in which you're creating a self-fulfilling prophecy. My answer to that is no more than the scientist is when he complies with the sets of conditions required to produce the results of an experiment. I think you can see this in lots of ways. The scripture, which I think summarizes the gospel reflection of this principle, is the 17th verse in the 7th chapter of John, which the Lord says, "If any man will do his will, he shall know of the doctrine, whether it be of God or whether I speak of myself." That's the Savior speaking. And I think he says, if any man will do his will, he shall know of the doctrine. And I think it is essential in religion, as it is in any other aspect of life, for this to be the case. There are some implications for this that I would just like to discuss, and then I'll be done. The first of these is that the process of complying with the preconditions to the acquisition of spiritual knowledge are complex and mature. They are not easy. Some years ago, a fellow writing in one of the church magazines told about visiting an inactive graduate student at Cornell, and in the course of the conversation finally saying to this fellow, "Why is it that you're inactive?" And the fellow, "I no longer believe that Jesus wants me for a sunbeam." Now, I know he was being facetious, but to some extent, many of us go through adult lives dealing with complex problems, and indeed dealing with our own lives and spirits, which are complex, on the basis of a sort of primary level understanding. It seems clear to me that the preconditions imposed on adults for the acquisition of spiritual knowledge are adult-like standards. And that's difficult because we sometimes want simple formulas. Last year on the panel that I participated with, someone talked about the great difficulty of dealing with the experience of having righteous prayers that were not answered. Now, that's an adult problem. I think that there are adult solutions that can be worked out. But that's not the sort of thing which children understand. I have a 5-year-old daughter who prayed for a brother and got one, and you couldn't explain that to her. But she's going to have to deal with some reversals of that formula in her future. We must be prepared for all sorts of clinical learning. One of the great insights that has come to me, which I regard as being an adult insight, was something that came from reading a British writer by the name of Charles Williams, who in one of his essays wrote, "The altar must often be built in one place in order that the fire from heaven may descend someplace else." Well, you know, I think you have to come to appreciate in one's religious life that spiritual experiences don't come right when we order them. And indeed, we build our altars one place in the hope that the fire comes down when we need it. I've attended lots of sacrament meetings in my life, and I have not had fire descend on me in all of them. Nonetheless, I think that I have had some experiences which were the result of which faithfully building my altar in those sacrament meetings so that I might be available for spiritual experiences at other times and places. Another aspect of this, it seems to me, and I don't know the extent to which this is fits neatly, but I'm inclined to mention it nonetheless, is that it seems to me that another consequence of the interrelationship between behavior and belief is that sometimes our behavior ends up defining our belief or fashioning it in ways that go far beyond even what I'm talking about. When I was in college, I had Neil Maxwell before he was big as an instructor, and he had us read a book. One of the books was an analysis of racial prejudice in the South. And one of the findings of this analysis was that young children grew up without a philosophical prejudice, but they simply learned to mouth the words of prejudice from their parents. And they started acting out bias before they ever believed it. And their beliefs followed their behavior. In much the same way, I think, people in the church preach what they practice. And doubt results frequently from engaging in behavior for which a doubt is a convenient explanation. That's obviously not true of lots of people, and the very mention of that would seem to disregard what are acute and real doubts for people who work hard at life. And I don't mean to do that, but I think people who find that their doubts correspond with convenient lifestyle, a convenient lifestyle ought to carefully look at the relationship between those two things. My final point in this relationship is another point which I take from the modern philosophy of science. In recent years, science has adopted a new humility, which is now to recognize that all knowledge obtained by man is flawed because it is subjective. It is limited by human sensory limitations and the unconscious biases both of the learner and the present system and conceptions of his discipline at the time, and that those inevitably distort what people learn. That was one of the things that Kuhn, in his book on the theory of scientific revolution, was at the forefront of. This new humility, which science has about the acquisition of knowledge, recognizes the role of behavior in the acquisition of knowledge. Ironically, that is the flaw which science and philosophy is often attributed to religion. That is, what people call religious experiences are inevitably distorted or factored by the internal biases of the people who seek them. But there's a greater irony than that, it seems to me, because religion makes a higher claim than science does now, because in our doctrine we believe that it is possible to be immune from the biases of our senses and our preconceptions and everything else. In the 21st chapter of 2 Nephi, we are told that, "And the Spirit of the Lord shall rest upon him, the Spirit of wisdom and understanding, the Spirit of counsel and might, the Spirit of knowledge and of the fear of the Lord, and shall make him of quick understanding in the fear of the Lord. And he shall not judge after the sight of his eyes, neither reprove after the hearing of his ears."
There is therefore a suggestion,
at least in our theology, as I understand it, that we have the possibility in the context of spiritual experience to be beyond the biases of our sensors, of our senses and their limitations, and beyond the biases of our own prior life experiences, and that indeed we can obtain pure knowledge. I regard that as a great possibility. One of the things that can be obtained by the practice of the ethic of religion. It seems to me clear that on these observations we must be therefore humble about our own doubts and refuse to give them greater emotional weight than they deserve, for frequently there is less there than meets the eye. On the other side, I do think that there are distractions associated with those doubts, some of which I have identified, many of which I have not. That they are especially distracting if they take us out of the ethic of religion and keep us from pursuing a mature, rich spiritual knowledge. That this is the highest kind of knowledge in life is clear, and to the extent that it is the highest kind of knowledge, it inevitably will require the most rigorous kind of ethic and discipline. G.K. Chesterton once said, "Christianity has not been tried and found wanting, it's been found difficult and not tried." I think that's true about the ethic of religion as I've described it. And to the extent that our doubts in any way distract us from that rigorous ethic, I think that they are enormously, that they do us greater damage than we can ever know.